My guest is David Attenborough. He's taken film crews around the world for his television series Life on Earth and The Living Planet. His documentaries explore natural history, evolution, and animal life. They were produced for the BBC and later broadcast in the United States on public television. His new series, The First Eden, starts Monday on many public television stations. The First Eden was filmed in the area of the Mediterranean, which has been called the cradle of civilization. The series explores the natural history of the region and humanity's changing relationship with the natural world. Attenborough has written a companion book, also called The First Eden, which is published by Little Brown. Attenborough was knighted by the Queen of England, as was his brother Richard, who directed the film Gandhi. I spoke with David Attenborough earlier today from the NPR Bureau in New York. Before we got to some of his adventures in the field, he told me why he focused his new series on the Mediterranean.
Well, I've done a number of animal series looking at the natural history of the world, as it were, globally. And in them, programs like Life on Earth and The Living Planet, human beings have appeared, it's true, but they've usually been either, say, Indians in the Brazilian jungle or Aborigines in the deserts of Australia, people who lived by hunting and gathering, but essentially in total harmony with the world, just as much as any other predator would be in harmony with the world. That's one kind of person. Another kind of human being that have appeared in the shows I've done has been people like you and me, that is to say members of highly industrialized societies, and they're usually represented as being wreckers, you know, ecological wreckers, ruining the environment. And, of course, the process of getting from the first to the second is a very crucial process. And the place where it actually first happened is the Mediterranean. And so I thought that would be, well, it's the oldest humanized landscape in the world. It's the place where the evidence of what has happened during that process is most easily and readily and amazingly visible. So I thought I'd do a series there.
Is there a period of history that you see as a turning point where humans became, instead of worshipful of nature or just, you know, involved with nature, they began to exploit nature and to exploit animals?
Yes, and of course we have always exploited animals and plants to some degree, in as much as we can't exist without them. We eat them. We eat either plants directly or at second hand, as it were, through animals that eat plants. And that was always so. But when we first started to exploit nature in a more extravagant way was when we learned how to tame animals and domesticate and sow seeds and reap crops. And that happened around 10,000 years ago, around the eastern end of the Mediterranean.
I've seen the preview reel for the upcoming programs, and one of the scenes, one of the shots, takes place in a cave in Cyprus, and you have footage of fruit-eating bats who live in this cave, and it really made me think about when you're doing a program like this, how do you enter a cave for the first time to make sure that there's nothing terribly dangerous and unexpected lurking in there?
Oh, you hope there is something unexpected lurking there. That'd be even better. The trouble is that sometimes you enter the cave hoping it's... and there's nothing there at all. That's the bit you want to worry about. That's not very difficult, really. I mean, the unexpected is not... Is something to be treasured, and indeed wandering around a jungle or wherever, you hope that you'll find interesting things. The sadness is when there's nothing.
Did you ever get into a cave when you were shocked by what you found?
Not on this trip. I have been in caves elsewhere where I've been fairly shocked by what I found. I remember going into a cave in Borneo. A few years ago, and this was a long and very big, huge atoll, like, what was it, it was about 300 feet tall. The ceiling was 300 feet above you. And there was a hole in the ceiling, and a shaft of light came through it in the far distance, and it was shining on a huge, well, it looked like a dune, like a golden dune. And as you got closer, it was shimmering, so there was a kind of rippling, shimmering light over it. Couldn't think what it was. And what it was a huge dune of bat droppings, and the golden shimmer came because it was covered by a carpet of cockroaches, which was slowly chewing their way through the bat droppings. And in among the carpet of cockroaches, there were little black beetles, which were eating the dead bodies of the cockroaches. And all around the sides, there were spiders, which had made their webs to catch such baby cockroaches as strayed off the dune. And right at the bottom of all this, there was a pallid white python, which was eating the dead bodies of the 1.25 million bats that were living above it. Well, I suppose that was on the unexpected side.
It sounds like an absolutely terrifying illustration of the ecological chain.
Oh, you're quite right. I mean, what was nice about that and fascinating about that was that it was such a perfect ecological community. The only thing that actually came into the cave was bought by those bats that flew out in the middle of the night to collect insects. And and actually there were some cave swiftlets which went out also during to collect food. But those two were the only input, and the rest was just recycling what was there. So it was, from a biological point of view, it was fascinating. I have to tell you, as a matter of fact, it was fascinating anyway. I mean, we in the end climbed up that dune. Smelt a bit, I have to say, it smelled a bit of ammonia. And by the time I got to the top, this 1.25 million bats had decided that it was rather alarming, and they were taking off, and they were circling around in a great maelstrom in the ceiling so that you could actually feel the wind created by their wings. And so they were flying quite close, and they were coming in between me and the camera. And so I thought, in order to comfort viewers, I might say, now there are a lot of people who think that bats are sort of kind of dangerous and that they fly and get caught in your hair and it's all a disaster. And of course, they have this very, very subtle and sensitive sonar system that makes it quite impossible for them to actually climb a cannon into people. So there's no need to worry. And the cameraman said, great, cut. And as he said, cut, a huge bat came and hit me straight in the middle of the face. So people never knew the answer to that.
Maybe the bat didn't hear about their sensitive
That's
sonar.
That's right. Like so often, occasionally you find these animals that haven't read the book and they don't know what to do.
So you used footage from that in your program?
No, I did, yes, but that was some time ago. That isn't in the Mediterranean. The little fruit bats which we were talking about in Cyprus are really generally quite innocuous little things, actually. The reason that they are very interesting is that they are the most northerly living of all the fruit bats, which are quite different from the insectivorous bats, and which don't normally have sonar. But these particular fruit bats live in farther south in the caves of the pharaohs, and they have actually acquired a sort of a very curious way of squeaking out of the corners of their mouth, so that they can find their way in the dark. And as a consequence of that, they can live in caves and so escape the winters of the Mediterranean.
David Attenborough is my guest, and he produced and hosted The Living Planet, Life on Earth, and he has a new series that starts on many PBS stations next week. It's called The First Eden, and he also has a companion book of the same name. In the new series, there's one shot where you've crawled into this rock ledge, I guess, a little rock shelf, where a baby seal has taken refuge. And it's a very narrow opening there, so you've kind of like crawled in, stretched alongside the seal, and you're describing why the seal would have to take refuge in a place like this and that the seal's really too young to swim. And it really made me think, what does it feel like to be in such in this spot that's made for seals and not for people, and to be narrating into a microphone?
Yeah.
And this has happened to you around the world, actually. You've been on tops of mountains and in swamps and caves and deserts, describing into a microphone what's happening around you and why. And you've been doing this in places that humans seldom go. It must feel... And people do stand-ups in front of the White House all the time. But it must feel funny doing that in front of animals.
Yes, I suppose it does. Actually, I think you've got to be very careful how often you do it, because by and large, what people are looking at the program for is not to see you and saying how clever and intrepid he is, but they're actually turning on to see the animals. And there has to be some reason as to why it is that you are sticking your face between the camera and the animal. And often you can, if there's not a good reason, then you are an intrusion and you shouldn't be doing it. The reasons that you might wish to do it are partly because you wish to direct people's attention to a certain aspect of the animal, partly to show how it behaves to human beings, partly to show whether it's tame or not. Those are the sort of reasons that are, it seems to me, make it justify. But I think by and large you ought to be careful how much you stick your face in front of the camera.
You started doing nature programs for the BBC in, I think it was 1954. What was the state of the art then for programs about animals and nature?
Well, the BBC, you see, was BBC television was set up primarily as television. And,
you mean live television?
Oh, absolutely, because there was no recording of any kind then. I mean, even recording on film, what they used to call kinescopes, was a very primitive and very foggy business. I mean, you could hardly see anything through a thick London pea super fog. It looked like people, characters moving dimly about, so you didn't use them very much. No, nearly all our television was live, and we were an offshoot of BBC Radio. And if we wanted to use any film, we would say we'd like to use film, and our bosses in radio would say, film? What do you want to use film for? We've given you a camera. We've even, on some occasions, given you two cameras. I mean, electronic cameras. Why do you want to use film? We've got a studio. So that they were not at all sympathetic towards the idea that I should push off to Africa with a film camera. So what we did in those days was to use to bring live animals into the studio, which of course were extremely popular because they always wet down your front or escape or bit you or something, and people thought that was terrific. The best thing was that we, in those days, and back in 1952, all of the television in the United Kingdom came from two small studios, each one about the size of a tennis court, not much bigger. And, of course, since those were the only two television studios in Europe at that time, you had to get a lot of shows out of them. And if you actually had a show, say, at 5:30 in the afternoon or 6 o'clock for the kiddies, and you had a little animal in there which escaped, people would know that the animal would be around in that particular studio later on in the evening. So that I remember one particular occasion we had a little flying squirrel, and the man who was presenting the show said, "Look at this charming little squirrel." And he leant forward, and in order to get the noise being made by the squirrel, the man with the microphone boom pushed it forward, and the little squirrel went hop, and it jumped onto the microphone boom and was off, you see. And of course the man who was presenting the program said, "Ah, charming little thing. Well, I'm sure we shall catch him later on." But everybody knew that he wouldn't. So they turned on throughout the evening to see. And of course he turned up in the end in the middle of a Shakespearean production. There was a little flying squirrel on one of the columns at the back. And he was around. He appeared in our program for about a following week before we caught him.
So was that a good enough reason to get you out of the studio and into the wilds of Africa?
The reason I, of course, did that was I wanted to go to Africa. It wasn't because I thought I was going to make terrific programs, though I hope there were reasonable programs.
But of course, you had to give them a good reason why they would benefit.
Yeah, I explained that, of course, in order to show, we mustn't show animals as freaks, I said. You mustn't show them just out of their environment when they do look strange, you know. In order to make sense of an animal and to treat an animal with proper dignity, you should actually show it in its proper surroundings. So eventually they gave us £50 and said, "Go away to Africa and bring us back a bit of film and be a good boy and don't cause us more trouble." So off I went for 4 months.
You know, the animal program genre has developed in several ways. You do very humanistic, educational, reflective programs about animals and their interaction with nature and with humans. But there's other aspects of the genre I'd like to ask your opinion about. One is the kind of Wild Kingdom type program. The way I remember this genre, this a couple of guys dressed as kind of great white hunters who go out and track down the wild wildebeest and maybe hunt it. They're very macho programs. What do you think of that genre?
Well, I think actually they're... that kind of show, I think, is now outdated, to be truthful.
I still see them showing up, to tell you the
truth.
Well,
maybe. And, of course, a lot of things are outdated that still go on.
True.
But I think that the taste of people these days, of viewers these days, particularly young people, is not the kind of mankind dominating nature, "Look how tough I am." Particularly not, "There's an elephant, why don't we shoot it?" And not, "There's another one, let's throw a net over it and strangle it." No. I think people these days are very much more sensitive to the rights of animals and the dignity of animals and the respect that animals deserve. And they appreciate much more, thank goodness, the kind of program which attempts to show the animal as it truly is, living in its own environment and in as undisturbed a way as possible.
There's another kind of show now that's very popular in America, and that is the... Perhaps I'm being unfair here, but a lot of the shows about animals seem to really show off how cute the animals are, as if there were teddy bears romping around together in the wild.
Yeah, I mean the kind of Up Pop Mother Frog kind of program, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, I don't think people need that either these days. I actually think that in the last... in my lifetime, in my broadcasting lifetime, which is 35 years odd, the whole attitude of the public to animals has changed. And people now actually have a great sensitivity and interest in finding out how animals exist and how they live. And you don't have to say, isn't it cute because it's like a little baby? Or you don't have to anthropomorphize and say, you know, you can see that he's having his little joke or that sort of thing. People are now much more... perceptive about the true nature of animals, and they want to see what really happens.
Well, I want to talk with you some more about your experiences creating television programs about humans and people and nature. But first, we're going to take a short break. My guest is David Attenborough, who produced and hosted the series Life on Earth and The Living Planet. A new series is going to begin on many PBS stations this Monday, and the series is called The First Eden. And it's about the Mediterranean. There's also a companion book of the same name. We'll talk some more after the short break. This is Fresh Air. David Attenborough is my guest. Well, a couple of minutes ago, you were telling us about that very first trip that you made to Africa to do a film for the BBC. You must have had comparatively primitive equipment to go off with, film equipment.
Oh, in those days, I mean, in the 50s, they were primitive to a degree. I mean, the camera worked by clockwork. You wound it up, and it could only take 100-foot reels. That's only 2 minutes 40 before you had to change the film, and it only took a run of about 30 seconds or something of that sort. And there was no way in which you could actually link that to a recorder so that it synchronized the film and sound tape together. So the result was really very primitive indeed. And our lenses were comparatively short focal length, so you were jolly lucky if you could actually see the animal in the far distance. I mean, you certainly couldn't get the sort of close-up of its right nostril, which is what you can do today. And the whole thing has been transformed. But that was part of the excitement, really, because every year you got a new bit of equipment. Every year you thought, gosh, that meant we could do this, or we could do that, or we could go and get this new view of that. And so that means, actually, that since we've now reached almost the limit of optical refinements, it means now that the thing is getting very tough because, you know, in Life on Earth we showed a mole running down its tunnel, and everybody said, that's fantastic. Gosh, did you see that show we saw? We went actually followed a mole and it went down into its tunnel and we saw it running along and catching worms. Isn't it amazing how they did that, see? And then, of course, next year, someone else does it, and they say, isn't it boring? It's nothing but moles, you know, going down tunnels. Oh, God, I wish they'd find something new. So it's quite tough making these shows.
You always feel like you have to top your last performance.
You expect that, or I don't know about me expecting, but certainly the audience expects that you get something, that you try and do new things every now and again.
What I can't figure out is, when you go into the field, you frequently know what you're looking for and what type of rare animal you're going in search of. How do you know where to look and when to look?
Well, you are quite right, and that I perhaps should have mentioned as one of the revolutionary changes in natural history filmmaking between over the last 30 years. 30 years ago, if you went out into the forest, there wasn't anybody there. There was just you and perhaps some of the local people. But they hardly ever met another European who was studying the animals. But in this last 30 years, there had been a huge change in the science of zoology. And whereas 30 years ago, if you were a scientist, by and large, your work was in a laboratory looking at dead animals or with any luck, a sort of white rat running around a maze. These days, behavioural scientists and zoologists and naturalists are out in the field actually watching what the animals do. So wherever you go, there is likely to be somebody who knows something about that animal and has watched it in the field. And you may think that if someone came up to a scientist who spent 20 years of his life in appalling conditions watching the behaviour of a monkey troop, and I turn up and say, well, we'd just like to get the aggressive display, which has been very seldom seen and never filmed, of this particular troop, and we know you can do it, will you show us? You might think those people would say, you're crazy. I mean, I've spent 20 years trying to do that. You think I'm just going to give you the cream, get lost. Well, I would understand it if they said that, but I can say, with my hand on my heart, that they have never once ever said anything like that at all. What they have said, you go to these far-flung parts of remotest Africa and they say, hi, come in, so you're interested in my animals that I'm so crazy for. We're delighted to see you. Let me show you this. I'm so proud of them. I think they're so interested, and I'm delighted to show you. And so we are able to get insights into animal behaviour and animals that you could never, never get working entirely by yourself.
That's interesting. Now, a lot of our listeners have seen you in what appears to be pretty risky circumstances, for a shot of an animal or for a certain aspect of nature. Did you ever have to decide how far you were willing to go in order to get a good shot?
I decided it was too far.
Was there a shot that you decided was too far?
No. Well, no, I'm not one of these brave chaps. I'm a dyed-in-the-wool coward. If I think that rhinoceros is going to charge, I get up the tree before it charges. All my friends are not like that. I have a number of friends who make natural history films who simply love being charged by rhinoceroses and will actually deliberately sort of go a bit closer. But my view is that if I get back from having made one of these films for the BBC and said, with a little sack full of jingling cogwheels and broken glass, and say, well, here it is, that's the camera, you see, I was charged by a rhinoceros, I was really very, very intrepid, and it beat the camera to pulp into the ground, they don't say, well done, you brave reporter. They say, what do you mean, looking after BBC equipment in that kind of way? You should be more careful. And they're quite right. So I make it my my policy not to be charged and not to get in danger. Mine, of course, every now and again you do something silly, but that's nearly your fault, and it's by mistake as far as I'm concerned.
So no close calls?
Not really. No. I mean, every now and again, I mean, sometimes you do silly things. I mean, I remember very foolishly when I was much younger thinking a snake was a non-poisonous snake and handling it with some degree of aplomb, and I had it in my hand, and when I suddenly realised that it wasn't one of those harmless things, but it was one bite, certain death. And I was holding it by the throat at the time. The difficulty was to know how to stop holding it by the throat without getting bitten. But it was all right in the end.
Your brother is the director, Richard Attenborough, who did the films A Chorus Line and Gandhi, among others. Once you started getting on camera and involved with television, was there any sense of competitiveness between you?
Oh, no, not at all. No. His line of country and his expertise and his skills are absolutely different from mine, such as mine are. I mean, the whole technique is quite different. You see, he by and large, actors, the more you get them to repeat what they're going to do, the better they get. I can assure you, with gorillas, it's different. I mean, they do it once and that's it. And if you haven't got it that time, they don't want to know. So they don't repeat. And not only that, but I work with a crew. I mean, when we go out, there's only five of us. When my brother goes out, there's 500.
You were the BBC program director for a while. This is what, in the late 60s, early 70s?
70s.
And then you stepped down from that, and you went back into television and started not only producing but hosting. I think I know several people who are in management who'd love to probably be back in production, but it's considered a step down once you're in management. Was it a difficult move for you to make to get out of one of the top management positions of the BBC and decide you want to make programs again?
No, not at all difficult, really, to be truthful. I mean, I I had a marvellous job for the first 4 years because I was starting a new network, and I had tens of millions of pounds to play with to commission new programmes and new ideas and develop new schedules and schedules. And so I had really a marvellous time. But then things changed. I mean, I then took editorial responsibility for both of BBC's networks, and then it became much more to do with finance and trade unions and politicians and computers, and what I enjoyed doing is making programmes. So I didn't, by the time I'd done 8 years of administration, you know, I'd played the piano and educated the kids and got the house, so what the hell, you know, why didn't you go back and do what you enjoy doing, which is what I did.
Your new series is on the Mediterranean. What kind of shape is the Mediterranean in now, ecologically, the sea itself?
Well, it is marginally better than it was. You can say that. But 10 years ago, it was dying. And there wasn't much doubt about that. Everybody, and quite a lot of people, thought that it would die totally, that the amount of effluent, of sewage, of chemical pollution, of oil spills, of overfishing, just the general enormous concentration of people without any care whatsoever for the environment that were clustered around its shores would seal its fate. And right at the last moment, well, the countries around could see this happening. And, of course, economically, the sea is very important to them, if only for tourism. And here you had a situation where the most expensive and fashionable beaches on the whole of the Mediterranean, indeed probably all the world, in the south of France, you were expecting people to come down to these places and bathe amongst raw sewage and dead fish. And something had to be done. And it wasn't any good just France doing anything about its beaches, because unless somebody further along the seaboard did something about them, or somebody on the other side of the sea in North Africa did something about them, then it would be just as bad. So, in fact, you had to have an international conference. And the amazing thing was, you see, that the countries around the Mediterranean are just about as varied as any countries you can find. I mean, there are Christians and there are Muslims and there are black and there are white and rich and poor and communist and capitalist. And you would think all those people who are at this very moment still fighting at the eastern end of this of the sea would never, never sit down together. Well, they did, and are still doing so. And they actually agreed on how to measure pollution and how to control pollution.
So this international cooperation has left you optimistic?
Well, the answer is marginally and hopefully, yes.
David Attenborough, thank you very much for talking with us about your work.
Okay.
My guest has been David Attenborough. He produced the TV series The Living Planet and Life on Earth. His new series, The First Eden, traces the natural history of the Mediterranean and man's changing attitudes toward the natural world. The series begins Monday on many PBS stations. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.